political revolution. And we'll also link to your articles at The Intercept as you continue to cover this issue. For those who didn't get to see Democracy Now! On January 1st, you can go to democracynow.org and see the Belmarsh Tribunal excerpts of it, looking at the case of Julian Assange, whose final appeal goes before a London court on February 20th and 21st. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for the first edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new laws take effect in Oregon as 2024 begins. A Multnomah County jail deputy may lose his law enforcement license for allegedly punching an inmate in the face. And in international news, the World Bank says global debt has reached crisis levels. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 2nd, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. 2024 means new laws are taking effect in Oregon, many of which were passed in the 2023 legislative session. One law, Senate Bill 82, will no longer allow insurance companies to use wildfire risk maps to make decisions on the price of homeowners' insurance. Another House Bill, 2984, also taking effect today, will require cities to allow commercial buildings to be converted into housing without the usual bureaucratic roadblocks. It's intended to help speed housing production and development amid Oregon's housing shortage. A new tax credit for kids starts in 2024. The Oregon Kids Credit helps families that make less than $25,000 a year with a $1,000 tax credit per child. New higher penalties for shoplifting are in effect. That law will help prosecutors charge repeat offenders. Two House bills from the last session take aim at paramilitary activity and domestic terrorism. They allow the Attorney General to investigate alleged paramilitary activity, and they can ask a judge to block any of these activities that would infringe on free speech or intimidate people. One of the bills also creates a new felony crime for domestic terrorism that includes damaging critical infrastructure or dispersing toxic substances. Driving under the influence laws were changed to include Kratom, an herbal substance that can produce opioid and stimulant-like effects. Previously, there was a loophole for drivers under the influence of Kratom. Election offices in Oregon are hurting for staff going into an important election year. Many workers and officials in these offices have left because of the politically charged environment. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Going into a big election year, staffing at elections offices in Oregon is an issue, according to a study. Staff-to-voter ratios vary widely between counties, depending on their size, but average about one staff member per 27,000 voters statewide. Paul Manson with Portland State University helped conduct the research and says there are warning signs flashing as this election year ramps up. He says it's a challenge for election offices to find workers in this politically charged environment.
That came up in our interviews where one out of five clerks, we actually had to stop the interviews because it became so difficult for them to talk about what they're hearing from members of the public and a sense of sort of attack and threats towards their offices to the point where some aren't comfortable even sharing what they do for a living outside of work.
Manson says low pay also makes it hard to recruit and retain people to work in elections offices. He says the county-level funding model, which is tied to the real estate market, presents challenges as well. Manson says these pressures have led election officials to leave the profession.
It's clearly institutional knowledge that's going to be walking out the door, and it's going to be another contentious presidential election cycle where we're going to need to be super sharp and transparent about this work for keeping public trust.
Manson says another pressure on workers is a growing list of public records requests, which officials have deadlines to respond to. He says there are a few ways the state could help election staff.
It might be creating a state public records request clearinghouse or a training position that helps support these counties in doing that training. So that's a real quick and immediate piece that I think would take a load off of clerks' shoulders. Longer term, reevaluating how funding happens for these offices is also critical.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A former Multnomah County jail deputy is being investigated by the state for allegedly punching an inmate in the face in 2021. Nicholas Alberts is accused of dishonesty, discrimination, and excessive use of force, according to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Alberts actually ran for county sheriff the same year while the incident was being investigated. He resigned shortly after the May 2022 primary, so the sheriff's office closed their case on him. But as of September, Alberts needed to renew his law enforcement certification in order to become an unarmed security guard. On April 6, 2021, while working in the mental health unit in one of the county jails, he allegedly punched a transgender inmate in the face. Then he intentionally used incorrect pronouns when referring to her, and there were discrepancies between how he reported on the incident at the time and months later after viewing video footage. A review of the incident concluded that Alberts failed the moral fitness standards of the job. The case will be reviewed by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training in May, and the board may decide that he is not allowed to work in law enforcement in Oregon in the future. State Department of Ecology has named parts of three Washington rivers as outstanding resource waters, the Napiqua, Cascade, and Green Rivers. Suzanne Potter has the details on what these additional protections mean.
Portions of three Washington rivers, the Cascade, Green, and Napiqua, now have an extra layer of protection thanks to a special designation from the Washington State Department of Ecology. The Outstanding Resource Waters designation under the Clean Water Act means the rivers will be protected from future pollution and degradation. In 2019, Chris Korbulik became the first kayaker ever to descend the remote Napiqua, but he had to carry his kayak 7 miles over a 6,400-foot pass to get there.
You get into that valley and it feels like you have gone way back in time to before industrial and commercial humans were affecting the landscape here so much. And it's so beautiful and so distinct in its appearance. Just completely looks like a Glacier Peak wilderness paradise.
The designation comes after 2 years of input from the public, tribes, nonprofits, and government agencies, and does not affect private land or state timberlands. The Cascade River provides drinking water to 56,000 customers and contributes 30% of Puget Sound's fresh water. Anacortes City Councilperson Carolyn Moulton says the new protections will help keep the Cascade pristine.
It's just another step forward in keeping our clean water clean, and it's way less costly to keep something clean than it is to clean it up later. It's nice to actually be ahead of pollution.
Susan Saul has advocated for the Green River since the 1970s. She says its trail system takes hikers through a remarkable old-growth forest that somehow withstood the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens unscathed.
Forests downstream and upstream were blown down in the eruption, but you can experience this remnant of ancient forests that survived the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens because of quirks in the landscape that protected it.
The Green River is home to a winter steelhead run. It provides clean water for downstream communities and is also eligible for federal wild and scenic river status. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Washington News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The American College of Physicians says voting is good for your health. Anti-vaccine candidates build strength in state legislatures. And states increasingly consider partisan school board elections. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. If there is more voter participation, there will be better health care policies and therefore better health care.
American College of Physicians President Dr. Omar Atik says voting and health are directly connected. New College of Physicians research published in the Annals of Internal Medicine finds so much health care access is determined by politics that states where it's easier to vote are significantly healthier. Anti-vaccine candidates are racking up wins in state elections while childhood vaccination rates drop. In Louisiana, 29 candidates endorsed by Stand for Health Freedom opposed to mandatory vaccinations won in off-year elections last fall. Republican State Representative Kathy Edmondson says the government should not trump parental rights.
It's all about freedom. Mandates are not about freedom. Mandates are about restrictions. You can opt out. You have an exemption if you so choose.
The state has the third lowest child vaccination rate and may be low enough to hurt public health. At least six states are looking at making school board candidates declare their party affiliation on the ballot. Opponents say it's important not to politicize school finances or the hiring of staff, but supporters, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, say too often voters back candidates whose views they oppose.
So we want transparency. We want people to be able to do what they think is best and educating voters to the maximum degree.
A dozen states will implement laws this year banning so-called ghost guns. Democratic Colorado Governor Jared Polis says the firearms, often assembled at home or 3D printed without serial numbers, allow owners to evade background checks.
These pre-assembled, click-together, untraceable, deadly weapons are a very dangerous loophole. We are taking an important step to close that loophole.
Police say the number of ghost guns used in crimes is rising quickly. The U.S. had nearly 40 mass shootings last year, with more than 200 people killed. The mayors of Chicago, Denver, and New York say Texas Governor Greg Abbott has resumed what they call the inhumane and dangerous busing of migrants to their cities. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson says families are arriving unannounced in the cold early morning hours and straining city resources.
Well, what we have is clearly an international and federal crisis that local governments are being asked to subsidize, and this is unsustainable.
New York City is receiving nearly 4,000 migrants a week. Mayor Eric Adams is telling bus companies to give advance notice of their arrival. The mayors want more federal migrant aid and faster work authorizations. New border policies combined with a foreign aid package are stuck in congressional negotiations. And year-end remarks by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts focused on the promise and risks of artificial intelligence. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
50 years ago, President Richard Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act into law, establishing protections that saved species such as the bald eagle, peregrine falcon, and gray wolf from extinction. As Suzanne Potter reports, the recovery work that was jump-started by the act continues.
A new report from the Endangered Species Coalition highlights work that continues today to help many species recover, including the Chinook salmon in Northern California. Barry McCovey, Jr., with the Yurok Tribe's Fisheries Department, says the Act's protections paved the way.
I think it's made a huge difference for ecosystems and for wildlife. I know on the Klamath River, we've made a lot of progress on river and ecosystem restoration based off of protections granted through the Endangered Species Act.
The Klamath River Renewal Corporation will open up 400 miles of salmon habitat upriver by removing four dams on the Klamath near the California-Oregon border. Crews have already taken the first dam down, called Copco 2. In 2 weeks, workers will start breaching three more dams and draining the reservoirs, with complete removal expected by next winter. McCovey says, historically, the Klamath had the third largest salmon run on the West Coast, behind the Columbia and Sacramento rivers.
Millions of salmon used to migrate up the Klamath River, but because of mining or logging or diversions or agriculture and now climate change, the river has been severely impacted, and now only 10% of the historic numbers still exist in the Klamath River.
The Endangered Species Act works by preventing listed species from being harmed or killed, by protecting species habitats, and by creating plans to restore healthy populations. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with some scattered showers and a low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 46. Today in history, in 1974, President Nixon signed a bill lowering the maximum speed limit in the U.S. to 55 miles per hour in order to conserve gasoline during the OPEC embargo. The quote of the day is from American writer and professor Isaac Asimov, who was born this day in 1920. He said, quote, "Those people who think they know everything are a great annoyance to those of us who do." The city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the Menominee Nation are working on an agreement to open a new casino and entertainment complex. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A proposed local agreement between the Menominee Nation and the city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, to open a casino and entertainment complex is scheduled for a key vote this week. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM reports.
The Menominee want to team with Hard Rock International, owned by the Seminole Tribe of Florida, to open an off-reservation gaming hall, hotel, ballroom, and restaurants along Interstate 94. The complex would be about halfway between a non-tribal casino in Waukegan, Illinois, and the Forest County Potawatomi Gaming Facility in Milwaukee. Joey Awanape chairs the Menominee Kenosha Gaming Authority. He acknowledges the nearby competition for gamblers.
But the question is, do they carry the entertainment and the excitement as well as Hard Rock does? And the answer to that is no, they do not.
Gaming Authority Vice Chair Gary Besaw says the proposed ballroom would be perfect for weddings and corporate retreats.
We're looking at enhancing what can happen in the Kenosha area.
The Menominee and their partners are promising about $10 million per year in payments to Kenosha and Kenosha County after the complex would open. That's not enough to sway city resident John Bush.
How many millions of dollars a year are we losing from companies that don't want to move in right next to a casino? How many millions of dollars are we losing when people flee our community because there's a casino less than a mile or two away from them?
If the Kenosha Common Council okays the intergovernmental agreement Wednesday night and the Kenosha County Board signs on later this month, the Menominee and Hard Rock project would still need federal approval and the okay of Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
A new study looks at the economic changes brought about by the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska over the past three decades. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
Ho-Chunk Inc. sponsored the report by consulting economist Jonathan Taylor. Taylor's observations include the doubling of the tribe's middle class over the last 30 years. He attributes this to their multiple institutions, with about 3,500 jobs in Nebraska, South Dakota, and Iowa in 2022, and a combined payroll of nearly $200 million.
And that surprise change is really what American Indian economic development has been endeavoring to achieve across the country. And this is in a remote plains tribe in the poorest county of Nebraska.
Among the tribe's entities are its oldest and largest, Ho-Chunk Inc., as well as several for-profit and non-profit institutions, including a college, a hospital, and a community development corporation. He says the tribe's ability to thrive gained momentum with its steps to diversify from the gaming industry back in the 1990s. Lance Morgan, founder and CEO of Ho-Chunk Inc., the tribe's economic development corporation, calls the tribe's multi-institutional approach key to its success. He says failing to do this is one reason poverty is intractable on many reservations.
Unless you unleash the natural abilities of tribal people through these institutions, you never go anywhere. We have been really focused on the development of institutions and people across the board. And what's happening is that natural organic growth is happening.
Morgan says their population has grown by 30% in the last 8 years. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Condolences are pouring in for Clee Benally, who passed away over the weekend, his family announced on social media. The indigenous musician, advocate, and land defender was well known for his work on protecting sacred sites in Arizona. A cause of death was not listed. He was 48 years old. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The weekend before Christmas, hundreds of Portlanders gathered in Pioneer Square to hold a die-in, calling for an end to the daily Israeli bombardment of Gaza. Dozens of protesters wrapped themselves in white shrouds and lay on the ground around the giant lit Christmas tree. Over 20,000 Palestinians have been killed in the Israeli bombardment since the beginning of October, according to medical sources in Gaza. 8,000 are children under the age of 18, including hundreds of families that have been completely wiped out. An estimated 70% of Palestinian homes in the Gaza Strip have been destroyed, according to the United Nations. Here's an excerpt of the protests held in Portland.
In the midst of all the horrors of the past 75 years and 75 days, my question is, do all lives still matter to you? Or maybe I should be asking, did they ever really matter at all? Where was your compassion for all life on October 7th, October 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and up until now? Only a coward would blame the victim. Where was your every child deserves a chance at life? When Israeli soldiers forced medical staff out of a NICU facility and every single one of those premature babies died? Or when the IDF shot pregnant women who were waving white flags that had been on their way to Al Anwar Hospital to give birth? Where was your righteous Christianity when the oldest mosque in Gaza was bombed? Or when the IDF staked out a church and shot anybody that tried to leave?
Those were the voices of protesters in Portland the weekend of December 23rd, who held a die-in at Pioneer Square, then marched to Pioneer Place Mall. The march culminated with a sit-in at Zara, a company that has come under fire for an ad campaign featuring bloody shrouds surrounding fashion models. Protesters say the ad campaign by Zara was making a mockery of the genocide happening in Gaza. It's the new year, and experts say the time to build a disaster kit is now. They recommend gathering water and medicine before a weather emergency strikes. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In today's world, it's usually easy to buy whatever you need when you need it. But as climate change causes more extreme weather, there may be times when it's not safe to leave your home, or times when you need to leave fast. So it's important to have a disaster supply kit ready. At ready.gov, the federal government provides a list of basic items that everyone should have in a disaster supply kit. Some are like packing for a camping trip: water, medicine, first aid kit, change of clothes, flashlight, extra batteries, and food for several days. Other items are more disaster specific: dust masks to filter polluted air, a wrench to turn off utilities, a fire extinguisher, paper maps in case the internet is down, a battery-powered radio, and copies of important documents in a waterproof container. It's not enough to have these items lying around the house. It's best to assemble them in an easy-to-grab bag or box, and review what's inside every few months so you can replace any expired items. You may also want to consider preparing multiple disaster kits so you can keep one at home, one in your car, and one at work. So no matter where you are when an emergency hits, you have the essentials you need to stay safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Global debt has reached crisis levels, the World Bank says. That especially impacts low and middle-income countries, which must pay high interest rates and sacrifice full control of their economies. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Global debt is beyond control. The debt of developing countries is at crisis levels, the World Bank has just said. Supporting that view is a New York Times story headlined, "The debt problem is enormous and the system for fixing it is broken." The article goes on to explain, quote, "The foundational ideology, later known as the Washington Consensus, held that prosperity depended on unhindered trade, deregulation, and the primacy of private investment. Nearly 80 years later, the global financial architecture is outdated, dysfunctional, and unjust," end quote. Indeed, the world is awash in government debt, led by the U.S., Japan, and China, which together account for about half the total. But great powers have many options for handling indebtedness. Small, economically weak countries do not. What the Times account hints at, but never really confronts, is the concentrated power of the Washington Consensus. It reflects American and European economic predominance, not just a consensus of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, leaderships, the IMF, in which the U.S. has always had sole veto power, but also the U.S. Treasury Department and the global network of financial centers that stretches from New York and Chicago to Frankfurt and Zurich. Predominance means the ability to dictate terms of loans. World Bank and IMF decisions over many years have aimed to condition loans to poor and middle-income countries on their openness to private investment, free trade, and deregulation of state-run agencies, roads, railways, banks, and key industries. Openness translates to opportunities for Western capital to penetrate developing world economies, often resulting in the hollowing out, if not elimination, of local, private, and state-run businesses. Large borrowers must also deal with the high interest rates that banks charge. To ensure repayment, the World Bank and IMF preach austerity, slash social welfare programs to pay down the debt. Any family deeply in debt would understand the terrible choice facing governments here. Stay on good terms with the bankers by eliminating or reducing subsidies to the poor on food, health care, and fuel. Consequently, Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, says in the Times article, quote, "Even the most fundamental goals on hunger and poverty have gone into reverse after decades of progress." The global debt crisis is hardly a new problem, just one that is surging again. As the New York Times explains, quote, "Pounded by the COVID-19 pandemic, spiking food and energy prices related to the war in Ukraine, and higher interest rates, low and middle-income countries are swimming in debt and facing slow growth," unquote. Add to that the many barriers countries are erecting to protect certain areas of their economies, such as U.S. high tech from Chinese access on grounds of national security. In all, we have not just a debt crisis, but a development crisis, in which far too many countries do not have the financial resources to support decent conditions of living, from health and food security to environmental protection. Moreover, these countries often are the victims of rich countries' behavior, as in the case of climate change. As one source points out, the richest 10% of countries, representing 80 million people, account for about half of global carbon emissions, while the poorest 50%, with 3.9 billion people, account for about 8% of carbon emissions. For as long as I can remember, the typical solution to the debt problem has been to give developing countries seats at the table where decisions are made, and to convert loans into grants. A seat at the table might help if the major players, starting with the U.S., were ever persuaded to reduce their voting power. Even then, it is the loan conditions, the amount of money available, the high interest rates, requirements of local regulations, and terms of repayment that would still depend on the good graces of the major financial institutions. And those institutions, to put it mildly, don't believe in being charitable. As for providing grants rather than loans, well, that day is long gone and would be very difficult in today's competitive environment to recover. Foreign aid from nearly all countries, particularly in the form of direct grants, has been on the downslide for many years. The Times report is weakest in failing to report on bottom-up approaches to development in the human interest, Giving aid or loan relief means dealing exclusively with governments that may be corrupt, excessively bureaucratic and incompetent, dominated by the military, and authoritarian. In any of these cases, giving low priority to human security. Channeling funds to non-governmental institutions with successful experiences promoting human development is far more likely to help than providing unworthy governments with debt relief. There are plenty of grassroots development programs that, for example, engage in microfinance. Kiva is one. It provides small loans at very low interest to villagers, usually women, who are eager to start small businesses. The real choice for international financial organizations comes down to this. Do you want to bail out governments or empower people? I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 2nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jenka Soderberg, Mel Gertov, Sam Bowman, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show focused on police accountability in Portland.